Accession number
34794,
Reel 2.
Joy Hunter, Reel 2.
You can see you should never visit a person who lives on their own without a getaway clause. Lovely to see you. I do have to go now. I've got another appointment. Because once I start talking...
That's fine, Joy. We were saying you just completed your course. So would that be about December of 43?
Yes, December 43, just before Christmas. I'd done my 6 months and I had to go to London to do this fortnight in the city office. And I'd never been, well, I had been once to London before, and that's quite interesting, really. But, I mean, Mother used to go, because her father used to take family parties, but not the children. Lovely things from Aspreys. He gave them, which I keep finding tucked away in cupboards and things. And so I had to go, and it was absolutely grotty. It was literally in the city, in the most awful building, in the most dreadful room, and I hated every minute of it. And I managed to find my way there. I think... We must have been sent lists of hostels because people, young people, couldn't afford flats in those days. So they had girls' hospitals and hospitals and YMCAs and YWCAs and Church Army Hospital and things like that. I was actually in a Church Army Hospital and gas lighting. Mm. Anyway, then I went home for Christmas. Or did I? No, I think it was while I was there. I can't remember this bit exactly. I had one of their pink forms. I'd had one originally 3 months into my course when I was in Brentford. I had one of these pink forms down. I didn't know what it was. It was telling me to go for an interview somewhere. And it was actually at number 10. I don't think I knew what number 10 meant, really. I can't imagine. But anyway, so I had to go the 6 miles to Essendine Station. Well, then I got a bike, so I biked to Essendine Station. No buses, of course, in those days. And then, luckily, it went to King's Cross, and somehow I knew that a 77 bus started at King's Cross, or went to King's Cross, and then went to Downing Street. So I managed to do all of that, and I managed to get off in the right place. Wonderful, really. No barricades in those days. No armed police, no nothing, no security, just a bobby standing there. So I got off, and I said, I'm sorry I'm a bit late, I've come for an appointment at number 10. Oh, that's okay, miss, in you go. I said, where? He said, well, number 10. I said, well, where's number 10? I mean, you know, it was as dotty as that, really. Anyway, I got there and rang the bell. I don't remember much about it. It was very dark, I remember, in the hall, probably loads of rugs and paintings and things. And then we went downstairs, as you do in London houses. You know, you go up 3 steps to the front door. Because our first flat was like that. We had what's called a garden flat with windows, but down below. And anyway, so I was ushered downstairs to meet a Margaret Stenhouse. Absolutely super woman. She was really delightful. And clearly, looking back, she was offering me the job. But I kept saying, but I haven't finished my course yet. See, I've got another 3 months to do. Could you possibly wait till Christmas? We're told, she said, well, you can continue study here. Treasury has typing lessons and shorthand and things. But again, you see, the attitude of my... I couldn't tell my parents. Well, what would I say to my parents? They'd paid all this money up front and, you know, and I'd got another 3 months to do and... I'd no money of my own, and it was all just too much, really, and I never thought about working for the Prime Minister. Didn't cross my mind. So anyway, I had a very nice letter when I got back saying, we'd love to have had you, but we can't wait till Christmas, I'm afraid. But if you do get a job in this area, please get in touch with me. We'll see if we can get you back. And she did get in touch with me lots of times, but I was never allowed to leave the War Cabinet offices where I finally landed up. So I don't know what happened there, but it wasn't extraordinary, really, when you think about it. So I had been to London that once for the day, and I managed it. Anyway, so I had a disappointment at the offices of the War Cabinet, which were then in Great George Street, and the entrance was in Great George Street, just before you get to Birdcage Walk. And I was interviewed by Captain Rawlins. I can see him now. Shortish man, slightly balding, with a brown three-piece suit on. Not my favourite kind of... And Miss Brown was in the room as well. I don't suppose I knew their names at the time, but anyway. So I was interviewed, and I don't know how a government office would think of applying to a private, independent employment. They must have had people before, I suppose. And in fact, all of those... I even come across people now when I'm giving talks... who went to Mrs. Hoster's, got brilliant jobs and have gone on and on, not just, they started secretarially, but they've gone on to do all sorts of things because of the background, I suppose. Anyway, so I started at the beginning of January 1944. living in this Church Army hostel in Harrow Road, overlooking Paddington Station. And that very first month, we had a proper air raid on Paddington Station. So the bombs were hurtling down all round. And when we'd finished work, we had bed and breakfast and an evening meal, and we could wash clothes and iron and so on. 26 shillings a week it was. I earned £2, 10 shillings a week, living in London away from home, no money from home. If I wanted to go home for the weekend, my parents sent me the money. It was 43 shillings return from Euston to Stoke-on-Trent. We must have had one of the members of staff must have been a permanent air raid warden for the building, because she was on duty every night, and some of us would go up and onto the flat roof and stay with her. Now, these London houses, as you know, got four floors. We start with the basement, and fire buckets in those days were big red heavy iron things, and we had a stirrup pump which really wouldn't even water the flowers. And so carrying one of these buckets up four flights of stairs was something we tried to avoid doing too often. So if these wretched bombs fell on the roof and didn't explode, we'd kick them off into the garden. It didn't happen very often, admittedly, but it sounds quite good, kicking incendiary bombs off the roof, which I did occasionally. Well, once, perhaps, I don't know. Anyway, so when we got back from work, some of us volunteered to do that. I was started first in the cabinet offices in a very big pool of typists and Cheltenham typists and RONO operators, and there were two columns. I remember, I think there were three or four of us in a row that went right back that way, tiny little office here for the supervisor, and the same on the other side, whom we never spoke to and didn't really know. And I've often been asked about friends and whether I kept. I didn't keep up with anybody because I didn't know anybody. You went and you signed on. I don't know where we put our coats. I sat in the front row nearest because I was a shorthand typist. So work would go into Connie, our supervisor, and she would hand it out. And if it was shorthand, then we'd be sent to whichever office wanted us. We were on the second floor, I remember, near the Chiefs of Staff office. And I know where the clerk's office was, and there wasn't a lift. I can't remember. I don't know anybody else who worked in the building. I can't tell you who else. There must have been hundreds and hundreds of people in the building. We had passes, of course, to get in and out. And we did two shifts. We did 8 till 4 one day and 2 till 9 the next day. Can't remember about time off. On the 2 till 9 days, I used to get on a bus. It was buses only because not knowing London, no use going in an underground and coming up somewhere not knowing where you were. So I think a number 6 bus used to go down the Edgware Road and take me the whole way, I think. Anyway, on the days when I went in late, I would go into the city very daringly and walk round. So that's when I saw the monument and Billingsgate and places like that, and the old lovely old churches bombed and all boarded up. I didn't always know exactly where I was, but at least I did that. So I got to know a bit about the city, which I really have never done very much since, I'm afraid. And then I hadn't been there very long. Oh, again, these 6 copies we had to do. And I think I was sent quite a lot of times to the, I don't know what it might have been called, the Russian section, I don't know, because there were different sections. Because I had horrible little letters to do on what was then the sort of A5 paper, you'd call it now, with a long reference across the top, and then a short paragraph, a gobbledygook, so it could have been in code. In which case, by then you see Russia was in the war and having defeated Finland in 1941. So, as you know, we spent that awful journey, what did Churchill call it, the worst journey in the world?
The Arctic convoys.
North Sea and Archangel and Murmansk. And then I'd been there just about a month when I was sent across to near New Scotland Yard, Richmond Terrace, I think it's called, to work for a Major General West as a PA. And of course, I'm thrilled to bits because this is what I trained for. I hadn't trained to go and sit in a pool. And just his aide-de-camp and General West and myself. And he was preparing plans for the British Control Commission going to Germany after the war.
So they'd already started at that period in 1944,
yes,
preparing for...
Yes, they're making plans. Goodness knows how they thought they'd do it, but, you know. Well, of course, it was not long before D-Day, you see, so obviously they're being optimistic, I suppose, and obviously getting ready. And that I loved. I can't tell you how long I was there. I've got a list somewhere, but I think I mislaid it. And I really loved that. That was all hours. I mean, it was ordinary office hours. It wasn't shift work. And often it was very long, and a lot of telephoning to do and making appointments for him and all the sorts of things you'd expect to do.
So you were handling, essentially, as a PA, you were handling his diary, were you?
Yes, his diary and all the typing, all the letters, obviously, all whatever they were, memos or, you know, bulletins. I don't remember much about the work, except it all was desperate. Everything was top secret. I mean, it always sounded the Official Secrets Act anyway when you go into government service. But this was really top secret, obviously. And I loved it. And then I was called back, and I thought, oh, no. And back into the main big typing pool I went. And then, not very long after that, because D-Day was June the 6th, wasn't it? So it must have been sometime in March, perhaps, or I don't know, quite early on. I mean, I hadn't been in the place very long. I was seconded downstairs. I didn't know what downstairs was. I had no idea. Underground. And I don't know whether I went on my own or whether one or two others were sent as well. And we had to buzz on the door to get in. It was all alarming. And there were Marines on the door. One of them, they're all dressed in number ones, of course, very smart, delightful men, actually. One of them, I was amazed, I'd never seen men sew before. One of them was embroidering a cushion cover with a big red poppy. And he'd sit, you know, doing this. Anyway, when I went into the war rooms with my son, of course, they changed it all. They kept saying, do you remember this? Do you remember this? Here's the typing room. I said, no, it wasn't the typing room I was in. Like the one they took the other day on that photo. That wasn't where I sat. I know it wasn't. Because although they put glass in instead of walls, the door's in the wrong place. And there was another little room off it for the Ronio operator. And I can see how we all sat. And I sat here and the door was here. Well, no way was that room.
I think that's only a portion, isn't it, of the war rooms. It's actually
yes,
on
display.
Yes, there were
70 rooms, I gather. I didn't know at the time. But they've shut a whole lot off. And there, of course, we were the joint planning secretariat, so it was absolutely immediate, you know, smack on the hub. And we were responsible to three senior offices in the three services. So they were the kind of link with Churchill and the planning committee and everything. And we did 8 till 4 again, and 2 till 9, but 3 times a fortnight... We went in at 3 instead of 2, and we worked right round till 4 o'clock the next afternoon, so we did a 24-hour shift. There were bunks down there, and we did usually get a couple of hours in bed, sometimes a bit longer. And sometimes, if we finished in good time, we'd go out in the blackout, and there was a little place, cafe opposite Victoria Station, where you could get omelette and chips. Great treat.
What was it like, though, working underground?
Very stuffy. Must have been aircon, but I've heard all sorts of stories about people who put handkerchiefs over it and they'll come off black, you know. And, of course, it was electric light all the time. I've always hated strip lighting ever since. Very tiring on the eyes, I think. Very tiring. I hate it. I don't like it in shops or houses or anything. And it was frantic. I mean, you know, you just went in, you were given your work. We worked in pretty well total silence. There was no chit-chat in the office. So I knew their names, their first names. I did nothing about them at all. I don't know where they lived or anything. None of that conversation. We had a lunch break or a supper break or whatever time it was for about 45 minutes. They rushed to the treasury, to the canteen, and ate and rushed back again.
Was it? I mean, I take it then that was quite concentrated, intense work that you were involved in.
All the time. There's no sitting back waiting for work. Connie came down with us, which was lovely, so we did know her. And I suppose I'd seen one or two of the others in upstairs, but because I sat in the front row, you never see the people behind you, you see. So I know one's called Elsie, I can't remember any of the others. And I've had so many emails since that article in the Telegraph all those years ago. I had stacks of emails. I mean, literally, they were coming in like this, and they all sent me photographs of Auntie Flo, and did I know so-and-so, and she was in this, and that. Of course, I didn't know any of them.
But in reality, that's not the atmosphere, is it? That's not that... You know, it wasn't conducive for friendship, in a sense, was it, in that environment?
And nobody talked. I mean, total war is total silence and total secrecy. So, I mean, none of us knew what each were doing. I don't know what anybody else did in the building at all. And when I say total silence, I mean, my parents knew where I worked, but they didn't know what I was doing, obviously. once the door was shut, I never worried about being caught talking, the walls have ears, because once I shut the door on work, I just forgot all about it, which was a great help, really. So I never thought about it again at all. I was anxious to get home to see if the place was still standing, back to the hostel. I wanted my dinner, obviously, and then I went to bed, and then the next morning it all started all over again.
And to a certain extent, Joy, when you're working on that type of material, and I take it that you're concentrating on getting it right, aren't you?
Yep.
Is it a case that you don't, to a certain extent, you don't really absorb what you're doing? You're concentrating on the process of reproducing
it. Yes, and getting it done quickly, and then getting someone to check it for you. Because, of course, as you know, if you never check your own work, because typists never see their own mistakes. I don't know why they don't, but they don't. And I'm the same now. I can write a letter and then reread it and find I've left words out. I'm dotty. So then we actually typed the battle orders for D-Day. And doubly checked, of course, also might have gone, in a sense, where they'd have gone. And I don't think even that had an impact, really. I can't tell you what it said. You know, I just typed it. I knew what it was, typed it. And then somebody said to me, who did you give it to? I said, I gave it back to the supervisor. That's the way it worked, and the supervisor would give it back to, you know, the courier would take it to the officers. The officers would presumably take it to the VAP room. Cabinet, or I don't know. Who knows what happens to things? So it was very, very active. And as I say, every so often, about three times a fortnight, we did a 24-hour shift. But you see, everybody was doing it. Every man, woman, and child over about the age of seven was involved in some way or other, either digging for victory or running messages for air raid wardens or something. So it's terribly difficult. I don't think people can put themselves in that situation. And now when you think about this instant communication, how are they going to cope with that?
You were aware of the importance of what you were doing, though, I take it.
Well, yes, I knew we were in the hub. It was all action, and it was immediate action. And so once D-Day had taken place, it was a bit like the cork coming out of the bottle, really. Great relief that tension had gone. But then, of course, getting these dreadful reports back about mistakes and casualties and all that sort of stuff. So it was sort of up and down, up and down. And still frantically working, very, very busy, right the way through. And then being chosen again. And there are only six of us who went to the Potsdam Conference.
Before that, I was just going to ask you about, because obviously around the time of D-Day, it was the time of the V1s, the doodlebugs coming over.
Oh, yes.
Did you have any experiences
of
that?
Yes, lots of them going on over the time. And I used to take my honours. Sometimes when I went in at 3, it was going to do at 24, I'd take sandwiches and sit in St. James's Park in the summer, looking at what they call the chiefs of staff, those funny, whatever they were, pelicans in the middle of the pond, you know. And the buzzbombs would just be going over. Fine. While they're going over, that's great. I think I forget how many seconds you've got when they cut out. That's when you need to fall flat. So that didn't bother me at all. And I say I've got these records. It must have been the buzz bombs that kept coming. There's these records of days when there were 20 alarms in a day, you know. It just went on and on and on. And then twice, I think, or three times, I actually saw one come down or hear one come down. I went to live with a cousin of my mother's, who lived in West Ealing at the time, Hanwell. And, of course, the central line comes out into the open just before you get to the station. And one night going home, well, it was daylight, it must have been the summer again, going home, the train came to bang, stop like that, things all fell on the floor. And then I could just see out of the window one of these things going down like that. So the driver must have seen it, it had been stopped. Not that it would have hit, I mean, it was going past us, but I suppose he thought it was better to stop, probably told he had to. And another time the same thing happened on the double decker bus just after we'd gone round Trafalgar Square, top of Whitehall. The driver banged on the brakes, and the conductor shouted, "Everybody out!" So we all flew out and fell on the pavement flat, and it was the most almighty bang. Luckily we were all right, so I don't know how close it was, but terrific bang. And then, of course, when I was staying with my second cousin, we slept in a Morrison shelter, which wasn't much fun. They're like the difference, the indoor ones looking like a metal table with wire around it. And she and her daughter and I slept underneath, and Peter, her son, slept across our feet, ready to leap in if there was an air raid warning. And there were quite a lot of air raid warnings. And we could hear them banging around, because, of course, North Holt's not far from Hamel.
Do you get used to that to a certain extent? Because I was wondering if you'd felt, when you'd initially moved to London, some trepidation, because obviously there'd been a history of German bombing in the capital, hadn't there?
Well, everywhere, of course, Coventry as well. I don't, you see, it's a funny thing, I don't remember feeling frightened. Very strange, I must have been. Or alert, tense. And I can't remember. I can't remember sitting thinking like this and, oh, I can't go out, or I can't go to work, or what's going to happen?
So does it become almost partly almost routine? Is that, would that be the wrong word for it? But you're almost used to the whole idea of,
well, that's
this
how we
could
lived.
Occur.
Yeah, that's how we lived. It is very strange looking back, and I keep asking myself questions, and I think, well, I can't answer them, so, you know, just have to accept what I can remember. But it's this business of how you felt that's important, and I don't know. I can't remember, rather. And I certainly wasn't shaking, or too frightened to go out, or too scared to do. Strange. Anyway, yeah.
So you continued? Did you continue in the cabinet war rooms until the end of the war?
Because I went to the Potsdam Conference, and again, just about six of us were chosen.
How did that come about? How
I don't
that?
Know. We were, again, the Joint Planning Secretariat, you see, so there weren't very many of us, and Miss Brown, the superintendent of the whole lot, she came with us, not Connie. So she came, and six or seven of the rest of us. I don't know, there must have been a few more, but on the list, on the plane, there were only six of us out of the 15. The planes went every half hour from North Holt over about 3 days, except for Anthony Eden, who went from... I never can say it, the one in Sussex.
Tangmere?
Yes, Tangmere, yeah. He went from Tangmere with his lot. Everybody else went from North Holt. And we were given, I've got the instructions still, two long, big sheets of instructions. One had all the names of everybody, every single Marine, every single Batman, every single stenographer. All of those I've got. So I think the Imperial War Museum probably got one, but that's one of the things I've... And the other one was the instructions to those who were going, about inoculations, which were horrendously painful, because needles in those days were... Like, we had to have typhoid, paratyphoid and cholera. I remember I had to go to bed, I had a fever, and I had it in my leg, and my leg came up in a great lump, so that wasn't very good. We were told what we needed to take clothes-wise, how much we could take. We were told where to be, and the transport would pick us up. We had our photographs taken of passes. I don't think we had passports. We had lots of passes. We had British Expeditionary Force pass, we had a Russian pass, we had another kind of pass. I've got them all in my book somewhere, I can't remember all of them. Anyway, so the picture was taken and the inoculation was done, and we were told how much luggage we could take and where to go, and if we needed to take equipment we had to let somebody in the cabinet office know. And the other thing was, which I think it's a hoot really, each of us had to be weighed. The passengers all had to be weighed as well as luggage. I was down at Chalk Valley Farm doing something for one of these blokes the other last summer, and I said, I don't think many people these days would be very pleased looking around. Of course, a roar of laughter went up, and I can imagine some of them being weighed and not being allowed on the plane. So that was good. And then they did all the immigration stuff. We had health checks and every passes were checked and everything. And we had to put on May West, because we were going to go over the channel and we might come down. And we sat on the Dakotas. And, of course, they'd been converted from trooping. So, as you know, they're usually fully geared up and they're just hanging on by a strap, crouching. We sat on things that looked like plastic church Wall Street seats. I suppose they must have had some kind of anchor, but not very much. And there was a box in the middle with some orange juice in it. And 15 of us went each time. And our plane, I think we left about 12:15. And our plane, the pilot allowed the ladies to go into the cockpit. It's the only one that did. None of the other staff had been in the cockpit. So we went to we were flying at what seemed to me to be an enormous height. 7,500 feet, he told me. Of course, now I sit in the garden and watch them going over at 38,000. It's a giggle, isn't it, really? Anyway, the thing was to the air conditioner, the pressure thing wasn't on properly. And we all got this terrible earache, excruciating. One woman, when we got there, had to go to bed. She couldn't work for 3 or 4 days. She went completely deaf, dreadful pain. And we flew over Belgium first, I suppose. Magdeburg, I seem to remember, was pointed out. That was built out, isn't it? Anyway, we landed at Gatow, which again, of course, was in the Russian zone. And again, all the immigration health things. And I think we'd been given some refreshments before we left London. So I think then we were taken to cars. We began to be driven to Babelsberg, which was the very posh bit of Potsdam, with film stars. I think Marlene Dietrich lived there, film stars' houses, and some had got swimming pools in the garden, and each of the houses were all placed so that they didn't kind of overlook each other, and beautiful trees and flowers and things. And our driver was the only one who knew the way, so he led the convoy. And we drove, must have been 20, I don't know, quite a long time. And I remember passing loads of people walking, the sorts of things you see now with the refugees and the asylum seekers. And they were carrying bundles and pulling things. And I thought, this is very odd. And I don't know whether I marked on it. Perhaps I didn't. I think now they were probably trying to get out of the Russian zone into either the British or the American zone while they could, if they could. The other thing was that about every quarter of a mile there was a Russian policeman or a Russian army, and they'd all been told to salute. So after a bit, I thought we'd better do the Queenie thing, you know, because it's a bit rude, really, keep going past all these people who were saluting, every single one, and the ones at the junctions with their red and yellow flags, you know, directing the traffic, which I painted one, so much. And we got to this place, and everything had been laid out, and I gather the Russians were not very helpful. It was done in a tremendous rush. Our names were on the doors. I shared a bedroom with a girl called Pat Tobin. I do remember her name. She worked from the Treasury, so I never saw her at all, except when we went to bed at night. And each of these houses, the civilian women all slept in one house. And then another house was where we worked. All our equipment was there, Ronio operate typewriters, masses of stationery, everything laid on. Another house was where we ate. We had the mess house. We had 3 meals a day, silver service at each one, presumably by the catering corps, and also menus in French for dinner every night, French menus. I mean, the amount of preparation, just think all this backroom stuff that goes on before you get anywhere. And then the Signals Corps were based at the film studio and called it Elstree, because they thought that was appropriate. And so I always wanted to get out and see things. We did have a bit of time off, and if ever I heard there was transport going anywhere, I used to bag a lift, even if I had to just go and come back again. And then as soon as the Signals boys knew we were there, there were dances arranged every night, or nearly every night. And the message came through that if we could get the girls together, they would provide the transport. Some of them were absolutely appalling, awful. They went on until 2 and 3 in the morning, if you wanted to stay that long. It was a job getting out of it somehow. Wasn't really great fun, I must admit. Some of them were good, some of them were fine. And there was a band, 5 boys in the band. I don't know, one played, you know, and we got to know them, follow them around a bit. And so you'd get back 2 o'clock in the morning and be down again at 7 to start work again at 8. And then Miss Brown was very good. She did, I don't know why I was allowed, I think I was appalling, really. I think I perhaps wasn't quite fitted for civil service, because whenever there was a free place going, she always thought I'd like to go the same way that I got to Potsdam. So I went to Sanssouci Palace on one of the outings that was arranged. I went with Captain Norman, who'd lived in a flat in Berlin and wanted to go and see if it was still standing. He just arrived at the door, he'd got one seat left in his staff car. I was allowed to go. That was fascinating. I think that's the thing that made more impression on me than going to the conference.